Some thoughts on two media properties that I've been interacting with this year. One of them is a dystopian television series about a vision of the workplace and the personalities involved. The other is a game about a fox that fights enemies, discovers puzzles, and is trying to defeat a nebulous and powerful foe. One of these brings back the warm nostalgia of my childhood, and the other is about a fox. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. I play a lot of Battle Royale. While I find it absolutely captivating to land on an island full of people, knowing that my goal is to be the remaining surviving person, that's not a good way to spend all of my time with games. It's nice, when possible, to find a finely crafted, beautiful video game that takes up some of my time, allows me to enjoy it, and then lets me hit some sort of conclusion, some finality, saying that previously I hadn't played the game, and now I've played it. There's a variety of games that I've played recently that have given me this experience. Unpacking, which is a simple game about transition, finding places for things, and ultimately yourself, and is completely solvable in an afternoon. Or the game Celeste, which is a platformer wrought large, where a player moves through different parts of a mountain while also confronting parts of their own personality and growth. These games allow me to have an arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end. To that small pile of variants in my video game diet, I'm adding Tunic. Let's be clear. Tunic is Zelda. It's Zelda as created and reimagined in the present day. You wake up as a tiny fox on an island with no idea who you are or what you're supposed to do. Playing around with the controller, you eventually learn how to move, how to interact with things, start to fight enemies, solve puzzles, and discover why you're there. When I say this game is The Legend of Zelda, I really, really mean it. Every aspect of that original game from the 1980s appears here. Multiple enemies, a destructible landscape, keys and bosses and vaults, and all the manner of secrets and discovery that were baked into that original game. There are a few major differences, though, one of which tracks me on a very specific level. You see, there are prizes to be won. The gems or treasures of other games have been replaced with a very, very interesting difference here. You are, throughout the game, acquiring dozens of pages of the instruction manual of the game itself. They float and glow as any sort of major treasure would in any other game, except when you pick them up, you are shown on the screen a page from an instruction manual. And not just an instruction manual, a weathered, scrawled upon, used instruction manual, as you would find on a game that you had bought used from a video game store in the 1980s. The manual is stapled, it's worn through the paper. There's clearly places where hands flipping through it back and forth, looking for instructions and maps and hints, are causing damage and making things less legible. Not only that, but they've added an additional trick. While you're looking at this instruction manual, behind it glows a pixelated, cathode ray emulated version of what you were looking at on the screen. In other words, you move to a different perception of the game you're playing, going from a high-resolution, beautifully rendered 3D world, and then moving back to reveal that actually you're playing on a very basic system, and you're leafing through this manual to figure out what to do next. because you don't have all the pages, you miss out on maps and instructions. And as you push through room after room, fighting enemies and castles and bridges and lakes and swamps, you're discovering how exactly to play the game that you are improvising on without instructions. Maybe this sort of technique has been used before, but it's certainly the first time I've seen it, and certainly the first time I've seen it applied across generations. I don't want to spoil Tunic for people. It's available on a number of platforms. It will surely join the pantheon of games you can find and play going forward. But cooked into this wonderfully made game is this unusual and inspiring meta-narrative that you are not just playing the game, but you are playing an imagination of what the game could be, and that not only are you fighting enemies on the screen, you are also fighting to piece together instructions on what the game means. And I couldn't help but think about something I've been talking about for some time. The digital blurb. The idea that the things we are digitizing and scanning will not just serve on their pure informational level, the text that's written or the pictures that are digitized, but the actual references of decay and rot and modification that come through different media. This game emulates not just the experience of a 1980s game, but the experience of leafing through a 1980s game from the perspective of now. It took me a few days to solve Tunic to a level that I considered completion, and it was worth every moment. The second experience I'm enjoying is a television series called Severance, which is available only on Apple TV, which means it's going to be available on more than Apple TV as time goes on. The roughest outline I can give you for this series is that in the world that it portrays, there is a procedure called Severance where your work persona and your home persona are separated. You walk through a door or a gateway or an elevator at work, and on the other side, you do not remember what life you had. The ramifications of this, the drama, the tension, are not what I'm talking about now. What I'm talking about is that to portray this world, Ben Stiller and his company created a production design that hits home for me in a very, very deep way. It's clear that the production team behind this series were trying to capture a sort of desolation of office life and to give an impression of a timelessness and an oppressiveness of the 20th century. To do this, they studied certain buildings, certain typography, and certain computing and office equipment. And when I started watching this television series, in the same way one might look at a space fantasy or a war film and just kind of take in the background, I became captivated by it. The background was my childhood. They had chosen, as the look of the corridors and the office, the design techniques of Eero Saarinen. I didn't know about Saarinen's effect on my life for many, many years. He lived a relatively short life, dying of a brain tumor at 51. But in his professional career, he architected a number of buildings that stand almost on their own and in some ways feel eerily detached from standard human buildings. He designed the St. Louis Arch, the TWA building in JFK Airport in New York City, a building which stopped being a terminal for many years, but it was clear that nobody wanted to demolish it. And he had designed a building in Yorktown, New York, called the Thomas J. Watson Research Center. And if you dive into Saarinen's history, you'll find an architect who shaped how he approached things to his clients. His buildings do have themes of curves and windows, but each one was an attempt to either solve a problem or to take on the experience of living in a building from a new perspective. At the Thomas J. Watson Research Center, there were designs built in to foster creativity and interaction. The offices themselves were dark and oppressive. They had no windows. They were a warren, like for rabbits, with different doors aimed in different directions, but all of them converging on hallways that pushed you towards the only place that there was natural light, the front of the curved building. And along this hallway, employees would run into each other from different departments, and a number of open conference rooms existed in this hallway so that they had this beautiful view outside with whiteboards and seats encouraging people to group up and discuss what they were working on, possibly leading to corrections and insights and discussions. It was here that my father, divorced but dedicated to bringing his children with him whenever he had visitation, since this was a building built for science and productivity and interaction between employees, it was mind-blowing to me as a young teen. So much of our lives in childhood are messy and piles and interactions with others that are broken and hard to explain, followed up with a feeling that the world lacks meaning or clarity or purpose. But dropping me into an environment where it seemed everything had a purpose, where the Helvetica font signs and black and white color scheme told me that it was possible, somewhere, under some conditions, to live a life with structure and goals and achievement. And as a bonus, not only did these things exist in the architecture and design and fonts and climate control of this incredible building, my father would log me on to an IBM 3279 terminal, which was connected to what at the time felt like an infinite amount of data, menus and games and projects that I could leaf through and play. This was where I first interacted with the game Adventure, and where I first had the illusion that there were machines that could understand what I was saying to them and who would invent new things for me to explore. Just for me. My father would work on his projects for a few hours and meet with coworkers and catch up on what he needed to. And I, like a confused little fox, sitting on an island and lacking instructions, would stumble my way to discovery and wonder after wonder. It is clear to me now that after enough years, the worlds that I lived through, imagined or real, have now become the grist, the fuel, the raw materials that people are building worlds in now. And instead of feeling unhappy when exactitudes are changed or modifications are made to what once was, I'm delighted that people now are sharing the things that I thought at the time would be mine and mine alone, and that nobody else would truly understand the magic that was being cast by these glorious, sterile, fascinating buildings, designs, and machines. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Mark Pilgrim, James Bekoianu, John Sturm, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Manxalot, Sean Kelly, Dileep Reddy, Trixie the Cat, Josiah Lusher, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt.